Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us at 800-462-7413. Of course, along with your call, some topics to talk over. Tell us, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about tooth decay. Now, you may think that tooth decay is an old topic, but actually it is always a topic that should be at the top of our minds because it's a big issue with kids today. Bigger than ever. And the FDA, the ban on gay men actually giving blood. We're going to talk about the politics behind this, the science behind this, and what my opinion is of their particular ban that is still continuing for some gay men.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to hear it. What's our recipe?
Moroccan chicken with couscous. Do you like couscous? Do you know what couscous is?
Yeah. It's that stuff that goes along with something good.
Something else. I got it, Tom. I got it.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And to the phones we go now, Zorba, a listener with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's up?
Well, I'm brain dead, or I feel that way.
You're not brain dead. You listen to public radio. No one who listens to public radio is brain dead.
That's the truth.
They're brain alive.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But I lose words as I try to speak at many, many times.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'm just leery about everything. And why I'll tell you the truth, at 72, I am just losing it.
Okay. So let's talk about things. Not an uncommon thing, but let's talk about what's going on. Pills. Are you on any medicines?
Enalapril.
Enalapril. Okay.
So, oh boy. I can't remember that one, but it also has a hydrochlorothiazide. Yeah.
Okay. And those are the two that you're on?
No, atenolol.
Atenolol. Okay.
Those are the three.
Okay. How long have you been on the atenolol?
Yeah, right around, I would say, 2000.
What is it, Zorba, what does this do?
Atenolol is a beta blocker. I mention it because sometimes beta blockers, as you age, can produce a problem. We'll go into that in a second. So any medical problems besides high blood pressure?
Not really.
Not really. How long has this word-finding difficulty been going on?
Oh, I would say about 2 years.
2 years, okay. You went to your doctor, you talked to your doctor about it?
No.
How come? Wait a second.
Because you're here.
Time out. Because I'm here. Yeah. Da-da. What do you talk to? Have your kids noticed at all? Do you have any children?
I am actually in my store, and my employees do know that I am doing this.
Okay. So they notice that you're talking.
Oh, yes.
And they've noticed that for a couple of years?
They must have. They're only nice to me.
They're only nice to you. Well, after all, you are the boss. You are the boss, so they're going to be nice. You know, they're only nice to you. So I've got a couple of recommendations. First of all, I'm not going to solve this on the phone. I'm not going to solve it. But you can solve it. The first question I would have is the beta blocker part of the problem? Now, even though you've been on the beta blocker for a long time, you know, more than a decade and a half, sometimes beta blockers can interfere with thoughts. And I'll explain how that works. Beta blockers are very good for stage fright. So a lot of people, when they get on stage or they have to speak, take a beta blocker because it sort of slows down their thought process so they no longer have that fear of talking when they get in front of an audience. But as we age, sometimes beta blockers can have side effects, and part of the side effects can be word-finding difficulties. So the first question I would have is, do you need the beta blocker? And if you remove the beta blocker, will that help your speech? So have you had a heart attack, by the way, ever?
Yes, I did have a heart attack in 2000.
Okay.
But it was caused by gum disease.
By what disease?
I had gum disease on my teeth. And that's, I'm sure, blocked my arteries?
The reason why I ask that is we often put on beta blockers, you know, after you've had a heart attack. It's one of the things we do. Nonetheless, I would still talk to your doctor about that as number one. In other words, whether or not this is it. And you can often safely go off the beta blocker and see whether or not that's the factor. That would be the first thing I would look at if you came into my office. The second thing I would look at is something else going on? I might do thyroid. Check your thyroid, because hypothyroidism, low thyroid, can actually produce inability often. We can have a slowness of thinking. As we get older, hypothyroidism is not uncommon. It's actually a common thing. I'd get a comprehensive metabolic panel, look to see if your blood chemistries were okay. And I probably would get an MRI of the brain to see if anything else was going on, check the carotid arteries. I would do a full workup to see if something were going on in the brain. I would look chemically at your thyroid. I would look at the beta blocker to see whether or not the beta blocker was the issue. I would do an MRI. The other thing I would also do is I would probably send you to a speech therapist to get an evaluation of what is going on. So when you wrap all this together, you can see that I, as your country radio family doctor, do not have the answer. But I do think if your employees have noticed it, that you do need to work up. And I think this is something you should share with your doctor. I think it's an important thing, especially since you may have something that is fixable that will get your mind in a better shape to be able to find those words.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Good advice, I'm sure, Zorba, and kudos to the caller for calling.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes it's easier to call anonymously, you know, on a show such as ours, or send us an email and say, is this something that I should be concerned about? The answer in this case is yes, and what should I do? And sometimes it's easier to do that than to actually, you know, talk to your loved ones or, you know, or call your physician or someone. I got that. So you are absolutely correct. Kudos to her.
You want to talk about fluoride, Zorba.
Yes, fluoride. So let's talk a little bit about fluoride. First of all, let's talk
funny,
about.
Funny, I was just going to ask you to talk about fluoride.
Yeah, you know what? You know, fluoride. Let's chat about fluoride. First of all, let's talk about tooth decay. So tooth decay is still an issue. You know, it's still an issue. When I was a kid, you know, the slogan was, "All right, I'm going to sing it. If you don't want to hear me sing it, close your ears." You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent. So this is when some of our older listeners are old and creaky listeners will remember that. This is when people must have used to walk around with yellow teeth all the time. That was a big issue.
Leave me alone.
That was it. But they don't use that. They don't use that anymore. You know, as that. So enter Crest, which was a fluoride toothpaste. FDA approved it many years ago, along with fluoridated water. There's some places in the country that still do not have fluoridated water. If you're on well water, such as we were with our children, the recommendation by the FDA that I stand by is that after a child is 6 months old, you begin to supplement them with fluoride tablets. And in our particular community, you can get them free. In fact, anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, you can get them free from calling up the public health department, and you can give tablets or liquid to your children. And fluoride incorporated into the tooth as the tooth is developing reduces dramatically the risk of tooth decay. There's a tremendous reduction in it.
There's no downside or side effect or anything?
Well, there's always a questionable downside. So first of all, there's the anti-fluoride movement. And that's in the minority in this country. People say, I don't want fluoride in my, you know, in my water supply. It's a communist plot to, you know, get our children to follow. I mean, I remember in all seriousness, it was thought to be, I mean, when I joke about it being a communist plot, there are people who are saying, I don't want the government interfering with my water. Okay, well, let's take chlorine out of the water, too, so your water might actually now have disease within it. To me, this is a good way of actually delivering an important nutrient for public health. And most communities, probably around 95% of the communities in America, actually decided to fluoridate their water.
But isn't it a different thing, a fluoride in the water and a pill for a little kid?
Well, it's not different. It turns out you get fluoride and you incorporate it. If it's not in the water, you have to supplement it. It's a supplement, like a vitamin. And it turns out it reduces tooth decay dramatically. Now, there are other ways to also deliver it. Toothpaste, of course, is a good way of delivering it. But there also is a fluoride varnish, where fluoride is then painted onto the teeth. Many physicians may do that in the office. They do it when they go to the dentist. That's another way of getting fluoride onto the teeth, and that's important. But the other issues that I don't want to neglect is making sure that you get rid of sugary drinks, especially at night with their children. Mm-hmm. So putting your child to sleep with a bottle, so the last thing on their teeth is sugar, will increase the number of cavities that they have. And that turns out to be a great big issue. And it's especially an issue with people who are poor. Poor people, people who live in poverty, are much more likely to give sugar water and give juice. The idea, well, give my child juice. I'll give my child orange juice before they go to sleep at night. Orange juice has sugar in it, and when that sits on the teeth, it's not good. So if you are on well water, it's important to get fluoride. I think it's important. If you're on city water and there is no fluoride in your city water, you should consider fluoride supplementation. And, of course, fluoride toothpaste is the way to go. Pepsodent without fluoride is not the way to go. It's not the toothpaste to use for your children.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener with us in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Well,
what a pleasure
you.
To
thank
talk
you.
With you.
Thank you.
What's up?
I am wondering what you think of the new salt room fads. A friend suggested a few sessions for my 17-year-old grandson who just has a history of tenacious pneumonia and mild asthma, and now they recently found hydronephrosis.
Hydronephrosis. Very, very good. That's on the test, by the way, so I'm glad you pronounced that. Water.
That I'm going to flunk that test.
That's right. You're going
to somebody explain
that.
What that's, this is to me.
Yeah. Well, yes. Hydronephrosis is where, you could say it's water on the kidneys. It's where the kidneys are.
Right. And the reason I was asking about the salt room
what is the salt room? Yeah. We don't understand what that is.
Okay, this is something new that I only saw a picture of it on the internet. It's usually at the more upscale spas, and it's a room that's lined completely with salt.
Oh, I see. So this is a spa. This is a spa treatment where you go into a room where there's salt in the room and there must be heat or something else. I mean, I assume there's something else. So the salt room is a spa treatment. Let me kind of put this together. The child, the 17-year-old, you know, relative of yours has hydronephrosis, which is kidneys that are swollen. They also had pneumonia. They wonder whether or not this is an inherited problem. Meanwhile, I don't understand. His father doesn't want him to have his kidneys rechecked. Usually it's an ultrasound to look at the kidney.
The ultrasound, yes, but the doctor is saying, let's go in there and make sure everything is okay.
Go in there, you mean have surgery to go in there?
Right.
So who's the doctor? Doctor is a urologist?
Correct.
Yeah,
a very good one in our area.
So this is what I would do. First of all, I don't think the salt room in the spa is going to solve the hydronephrosis of the kidney.
No.
So I don't think so. I don't think that's going to do anything. And your grandson. Why your grandson has pneumonia at the age of 17 that didn't get better has got to be, that's a very important question. I mean, first of all, a 17-year-old with pneumonia, it's a serious thing. Pneumonia is always serious. But a pneumonia that doesn't go away is really serious. You've got to do it.
Yeah.
And finally, if somebody recommended that somebody, we don't know what's going on, I want to do surgery to look at that kidney, I would immediately say, wait a minute. I want to have a non-invasive technique to discover what's going on with the kidney. I would not let my child have surgery to see, quote, what was going on. Now, back in the day, when I started medicine, before we had good scanning techniques, before we had invented the MRI, and before we had better CT scans, we used to do, you know, exploratory surgery to look at something that's going on. But I would absolutely get a second opinion before I would let my child undergo a surgical procedure. I don't care what the reputation was from the urologist in the area. I would go somewhere else.
Oh.
100%. I'd go to the UW and I'd say, I want to get a second opinion from somewhere else. Your insurance company, let's assume you're an insurance company, you know, and they go, well, you can get a second opinion from somewhere else. You have to go within our, within the number of physicians we have. I would find another physician. I would go to a physician outside of that area that probably doesn't know the urologist, and I would get another opinion. I wouldn't have my child, quote, we're going to go in there and see what's going on. I'd want to find out what's going on by scans first. That's what I would do. Yep.
Okay.
The other thing that's important is there can be serious problems with the kidney at that age.
Right.
I mean, there are a lot of serious things, including cancer, which can occur, in kidneys in young children. So making sure you know what the diagnosis is very important. In other words, hydronephrosis or a swollen kidney can come from a tumor. And if so, you want to find out what that is. But you want to have the most up-to-date scanning prior to what you're actually doing. And then you want to make sure you're at a center that looks and sees lots of children with something such as this so that you follow what I think is very important, primum non nocere, which is Latin for first do no harm.
Right.
And that's what I would recommend. So when you get off, I'd recommend calling up the dad and said, you're right. We have to get a second opinion and find out how to do it and get him in to get a second opinion. And I would do it sooner versus later. I wouldn't, if it were my child with this, I would not wait on this. I would do it pronto.
All right. So you don't feel like the salt room
zero.
Would have any
zero.
Benefit to his
zero.
Life.
You know something? If you want to treat yourself to a high-class spa and and spend $10,000 on a vacation or $5,000 or $2,500, you go to the salt room, but not for a 17-year-old with hydronephrosis. I would call that quackery.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your show and the information so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. And speaking of quackery, Zorba, before the break, let's take a dive into the murky waters of medical quackery. Time again now for Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, this time we're going way back in time. Tell us about Cato the Elder and his cabbage fixation.
Yes, you know, quackery knows no bounds. I mean, so for looking at quackery, I honestly believe that we've got to look from the dawn of time. So this is not the dawn of time, but this is 2 century B.C. Okay, we'll look at Cato.
Oh, my goodness.
You've heard of Cato the Elder, right?
No,
you haven't. Well, he was the man back in his day. And Cato the Elder talked about some of the important cures that the Romans were using. Now, the Romans rightfully decided that cabbage actually was very good. And it turns out cabbage is an excellent form of vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
Cabbage, actually, if you have cabbage, it prevents scurvy, can be used on ships. And it might be that the Romans actually learned that and discovered that it was better.
So what's the quackery?
Well, the quackery is that Cato the Elder talked about that there were different diets for different classes of people. That's what he talked about. And different diets based on your astrological signs. So there was the diet for the rich, the cabbage diet for the rich, mm-hmm. and the cabbage diet for the poor. So the cabbage diet for the rich included cured meats, eel, skate, lobster, octopus, and of course, African ostrich and gazelle. That was along with cabbage. Remember, you had to have cabbage with it. The diets for the poor included cabbage,
along with
gruel. So it was the cabbage and gruel diet. Yeah. And then there were other things that when they made these diets, they went to the second step. It was the zodiac sign that also made a difference. So, for instance, if you were a Virgo, then you had to also eat the belly of a virgin pig. In other words, the belly of a virgin had to be a female pig. That was an important part of your diet.
Yeah.
So, it's very clear that Cato the Elder also had the quackery diet of the Romans, for which he has passed down this wonderful,
what's
wonderful
the diet for me? I'm a Gemini.
You're a Gemini. You know, Tom, you'll have to tune in next week to find out the quack diet, cabbage diet for the Gemini.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send it along in an email at
Zorba@WPR.org, or don't forget, post it on Facebook.
800-462-7413 is our number. We'll be taking more of your calls, of course. We have some more research to talk about right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, Moroccan chicken with couscous.
Now, do you like couscous?
Yeah, you asked me that before. Yeah,
the answer is, do you know what couscous is? It turns out to be totally different than what I thought
it was. It's some kind of vegetable, isn't it?
It's a pasta. It doesn't seem like a pasta. I thought it was like a grain. I remember years ago.
We went to France.
There's a lot of couscous in France because of the Algerian influence.
It's kind of a tasteless thing.
Well,
it kind of puts volume on something.
I mean, we add things to pasta, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about noodles, you put stuff on noodles, and this
is tiny little pasta.
Yeah. But there also are different kinds of couscous. There's Israeli couscous, which is bigger than regular couscous. They're kind of like little balls, tiny little balls. And they have a totally different texture and a different taste. I happen to like couscous. Penny, whenever I make couscous, she goes, "Oh, couscous." That's about what it is.
Well, it takes on the flavor kind of
whatever
what's on it, and it tastes all right.
And it has a texture.
Yeah.
So it's what you put on the couscous that counts. Nobody just has couscous for couscous,
right?
Like a potato. You know, nobody there. And they're not, well, there are couscous restaurants in France. They're all over France. I happen to like couscous. I like this particular dish because I like the seasonings in the dish.
Okay.
And so if you want to try a different chicken dish and you've never tried an unusual chicken dish, try this. It's Moroccan chicken with couscous.
Okay.
Okay. 12 chicken thighs and drumsticks. That's about 3 to 4 pounds.
12 chicken thighs and drumsticks.
Yeah, so you're using dark meat. It's a dark meat. It's a dark meat recipe versus a white meat.
Got it.
You could use white meat. I think there's a place for white meat and a place for dark meat. I mean, if you want to just have white meat because you're worried about the extra fat that's in dark meat, I think there are other things to worry about in life besides that.
Okay.
You know, I'm for pleasure in life as well as a moderate diet. You're going to use a teaspoon of cumin.
Little tea cumin.
That's right. Half teaspoon of cardamom.
Half a little tea cardamom.
Half teaspoon of cinnamon.
Half a little tea cinnamon.
Yeah. And what I do with cinnamon is I now buy smaller containers because I think the cinnamon kind of isn't as fresh. So sometimes buying smaller containers makes a difference. A teaspoon of salt.
Little tea salt.
Half teaspoon of pepper.
A half a little tea pepper.
Okay, so these are all the seasonings. The cumin, the cardamom, and the cinnamon are really the major things that give this the taste that you're looking for. And when you're looking for cardamom, you want to get a small container of cardamom and keep it fresh because the cardamom is also more likely to go.
Got it.
3.5 cups of couscous cooked.
3.5 cups of couscous cooked.
Right, you're going to cook it. And you buy them. They come in packages. You add water to it because it's a pasta.
Mm-hmm.
You put it in hot water, you let it sit for 5 minutes and it's cooked. It's very easy to cook it. Half cup of roasted peppers chopped.
Half a cup of roasted peppers chopped.
And you get that if you're looking in the grocery store, you get it in the pickle aisle. That's where you get it. I have times have actually roasted the peppers myself on my stove, and you know what? It was kind of a pain and it didn't turn out to be that much better.
Mm-hmm.
A third of a cup of golden raisins.
Third of a cup of golden raisins.
Now you could use dark raisins, but then then it looks kind of, then the dish doesn't look as nice. And so golden raisins, I don't find a difference in the taste, but the dish visually looks nicer. And my daughter, Vanessa, as well as my wife, Penny, but especially my daughter, Vanessa, has taught me the way the dish looks also influences the way we like the dish.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's true.
There's no doubt about it. And in fact, there are a number of books that I've now read since that about that. In fact, green eggs and ham, have you ever put food coloring in milk and then try to drink it?
I don't think so.
It's hard to drink green milk. Yeah. You've never done that?
Why would I do it? Why would anybody do it?
I don't know. Why would anyone do it? Just, I don't know, to be goofy. Two green onions finely chopped. Okay.
And my sheet here says cooking spray.
Cooking spray, that's part of it. You need cooking spray. So, okay. Arrange the chicken on a large rimmed baking sheet. Spray it with cooking spray. That keeps down the oil. Mm-hmm. Sprinkle with the mixture that you have, the cumin, cardamom, cinnamon, salt, and pepper. Okay, you're going to sprinkle it with that. Roast it at 475 for about 35 minutes till the chicken is cooked. You're going to want to turn it during that time. Make sure it's cooked. It's about 165 degrees on an instant read thermometer. If you do not have an instant read thermometer, go buy one. They are cheap. Mm-hmm. They are inexpensive. Or what I did is I went and bought a good $10, and maybe it was $15 one, which is much easier to read, much better. You want to make sure the chicken is cooked to 165 degrees. And then toss the couscous with the roasted peppers that you've chopped up, the raisins, the green onions, and you serve the chicken and put the couscous on the side, and bon appetit.
Yeah, sounds good.
It's really, really good.
If you want a copy of this recipe, go to Zorba's house and knock on the door.
Or, since you probably won't stop by the house, go to ZorbaPastor.org. You've got this recipe. You've got other recipes. You've got photos. You've got pictures. You've got the secret to a long, sweet life. That's ZorbaPastor.org or Facebook.
Yeah, I got plenty of nothing. 800-462-7413. It's toll free. Back to the phones now, Zorba. Welcoming a listener in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. How can we help you?
Well, this is Stan, the garbologist in Springfield, Missouri.
What? The garbologist?
Yes. We do a lot of hauling, and we have a problem with cracked hands.
Okay.
With cracked hands. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And I've tried everything there is from bear grease to goose oil.
Uh-huh. Utterbaum. Have you tried Utterbaum, by the way?
Yep.
Utterbaum. I mean, that's a Wisconsin thing. I don't know where you live if they have Utterbaum.
I'm from Minnesota, 59 years. So
Minnesota. Okay, so you know Utterbaum.
I even try Norwegian hand oil up there.
Yeah, you see, you know something. If you go out to California or New York City, they go Utterbaum. What is utter? And they think it's they think it's like Utterbaum, but they don't think of the utter of Utterbaum. So do you wash your hands all the time at all?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, we do a lot of scrapping and junking, and I'm usually washing them a lot with a WD-40 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I do get in a lot of oil during the day sometimes, but basically they crack right at the fingernail in the joint.
Right. It's a big, big problem with people who have their hands in water all the time, any kind of liquid all the time with that. Have you noticed a seasonal difference, summer or winter? Does that make any difference?
It's actually worse in the winter.
Worse in the winter.
Usually we wear more gloves and leather gloves in the winter when we're working outside.
That's right. And also it is drier in the winter. That's the other thing is the air is drier in the wintertime. Do you wear gloves often when you're working, or do you work with your bare hands?
Well, when we're in a real messy job, we wear leather gloves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question. Who does the dishes at home?
The dishwasher, my wife.
The dishwasher. But the reason I ask that is that a lot of people have dry, cracked skin because they use dishwasher detergent without gloves. And that turns out to be a big issue because it actually is the soap that you use to wash your hands is often the stuff that's actually destroying the top layer and producing the cracks that you actually get into your skin. Have you used any medicated creams from your doctor? Steroid creams at all?
I've never tried any from the doctor. But.
Well, I've got some ideas. So, first of all, when A, whenever you can use gloves, use gloves. Rubber gloves, dry gloves, anything to protect your hands when you can do it. That's number one. Number two, when you wash your hands, you want to use, when you can, a more mild soap. So if there's dirt on it, you've got to use a heavier soap like Lava or something else to really get off the grit. And Lava's good. Lava's a very good soap to use. But unfortunately, it's gonna take the oil off your hand, and so that's why you put oil on top of it. But there is a steroid cream, triamcinolone cream, TMC. So T as in Tom, M as in Mary, C as in Charlie. So TMC cream, which is a prescription cream, can do wonders for cracked skin. And what I often will tell people when their skin is really bad is they put on some TMC cream at night before they go to sleep, and then they put on clean gloves, gardening gloves, you know, which are cotton gardening gloves. You buy them, they're, you know, a buck in the hardware store. And you put these gloves on when you go to sleep at night with the cream. You may end up taking off the gloves in the middle of the night, and that's okay. But the gloves help the cream absorb into your skin, and that will reduce the inflammation. And you can often do that once a week, twice a week. Some people put it on every night in the wintertime, and that's going to help heal up those sores that are the cracks that are in your skin. And that's what I would do. I'd get some prescription cream because you've tried everything else and it's failed. Cornhuskers lotion, did you try that?
Oh, yeah. I've tried everything you can think of for 70 years. Even some of Grandma's old made recipes. I was even told if you drink better whiskey, it would help.
I don't think the whiskey's going to do much. You may forget about the cracks in your hands if you drink enough whiskey.
If you drink enough, it'll help.
Drink enough whiskey. So wait a minute. You said Grandma's home remedy. So what home remedy did Grandma have?
Oh gosh, my grandma was half Indian, and she always had herbs and things she was picking, and I don't know. I think she made it out of goose grease and something, but
and goose grease is actually goose grease
helped,
is good,
but you know,
but it's only so much. Lanolin is very good, but some people then become.
Yeah, I've had lanolin.
Yeah, we're kind of allergic to. I would try the prescription cream, and once again, you use it to try to get the cracks under control,
sure.
And then you stop using it for a while. It's very good to give your hands a break, but you know, unfortunately, it comes with the territory as a garbologist, and I've never heard the term garbologist, but I can just picture what you guys are dealing with.
It takes about 70 years to become a good garbologist. So you guys were talking about Tide soap the other day. You know, we're from Minnesota, and you know why the Eskimos wash in Tide?
No, I don't. Tell me about it.
Because it's too cold out, Tide.
Oh.
I thought Tom would enjoy that one.
Goodbye.
That's a Minnesota goodbye. It's a Minnesota joke.
Thanks,
thank
guys.
You. Thanks.
We appreciate the call up till that last couple of seconds.
It was okay.
800-462-7413, toll free. 800-462-7413. Now, before we take a break, Zorba, let's take an email question. This one comes to us from a listener, Abdullah, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Ooh.
Hello, Zorba. First of all, thank you so much for all the valuable information and advice. I always listen to your show on the internet here in Saudi Arabia. I learn a lot from it.
Cool.
Second, I have a 4-month-old baby who has a bulge on the upper left side of his eye. Please see the attached drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hold it up to the microphone?
Yeah, I'm holding it right up. I hope you guys can
look,
see it.
You see
hold,
the drawing?
Hold on a second. Look at your radio. Wait a minute. I'll get it. I'm sorry. It's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's right in the middle.
Okay.
I can see it.
Yeah, everybody can. Mm-hmm. It was there since his birth. We took him to our doctor, who has given him eye drops for 5 days. He said he had bacteria, but nothing has changed. Please help us, and thank you so much.
Sure. Well, first of all, one of the things that this can be is an infection called a chalazion. Chalazion is an infection around the eye, if you will, can produce this bulb, this bulge up there. Eye drops are a good treatment for that. But, you know, if you have a chalazion, usually it's painful, it's uncomfortable, it hurts, there may be a discharge associated with it. And if it doesn't get better, then the question is, especially in a baby this young, whether there was trauma involved and whether or not there's a little blood beneath that surface. In other words, when the baby came through the birth canal, or if there were forceps, and I don't know what the delivery was, or even if the baby is delivered by C-section, whether or not there's a little, there's some bacteria, some fluid beneath that surface. So I think if you're doctored, if the drops don't work, and that is not the case, that your doctor has to look and see what this is. And often an ultrasound scan of that area is going to determine what it is, or in some cases, if you think there's just simple fluid there, you wait for it to resolve. If it's not painful, it's not tender, you can often wait for it to resolve. And if it doesn't fully resolve, then sometimes you can freeze the area and pull the fluid out with a small little needle. That's another way to look at it. Or an ultrasound can give you the answer as to what this is. But I do think you should follow this through with your doc. And if it doesn't get better, if it hasn't gotten better with eye drops, I doubt if it's an infection. It's probably just fluid.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And obviously, it doesn't matter where you are in the world.
Yeah.
We are obviously online in Saudi.
We have some interesting research coming up. Stick around for that. More of your calls, of course. And some of your emails, too. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX. The Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, the FDA has changed its position on blood donations by gay men.
Right. So here's the issue. Let's look at the history. The history was when HIV first, reared its ugly head, we knew that it was more common in gay men, and so gay men were kept from donating blood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, this was before we had the HIV test. I mean, we have very good HIV test. HIV is not in the blood supply. It's not there. Because it gets tested, it's gone, it's not around.
Mm-hmm.
But the ban on gay men giving blood has remained there. And why has it remained there? Well, there's some politics involved, I think. There's a little bit of science, but the science is minimal. The science was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the FDA finally, stepped up to the plate and said, politics, albeit, we're going to allow gay men to give blood. But they have to have been celibate for a year, okay? They have to have been celibate for a year before they get blood,
yeah,
because we want to make sure that they haven't, possibly gotten HIV.
Right.
So they have to be
right.
celibate for
right.
a year. Well, the reality is a lot of heterosexual men also have HIV, and women also, let's look at women.
Yeah.
Heterosexual women also have HIV.
And there are no restrictions.
And there are no restrictions on them. I mean, so maybe what the FDA should do is say, well, we want everyone to be celibate for 1 year before they give blood.
Well, that would really decrease the blood supply.
Well, imagine on college campuses.
Yeah.
There are a lot
yeah.
of blood drives on college campuses, and if you had to be celibate for a year, can you imagine what those blood drives would attract?
Yeah.
Not very many people at all. And so there's no science behind their saying this because it can be tested, because once again, we test it. And we know that heterosexual men and women get
yeah.
HIV, and they get it from sex and from needles
yeah.
and so
well,
on.
Well, should there be some policy for everybody?
Yeah, the policy should be the same for everybody.
But
I think
should
the
it
FDA
be
made
no
a mistake.
Sex for the last year?
Yeah, no sex for the last year. You know how well that's going to be. And we know that that's ridiculous because we can test for HIV. In other words, we can test for that. We can test for hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. There are other diseases that we test for. We can test for a whole bunch of diseases, which they do. So I think the FDA did not go far enough.
This
and
is
they
a
should
silly,
be.
Silly decision.
Absolutely the case. It is a political decision. The FDA did not base it on science. In other words, if you're going to make a decision that gay men have to be celibate for a year, the same thing should be for heterosexual men and women who should be celibate for a year. And that, of course, is ridiculous. The answer is we know how to test for HIV. It is successful, and the FDA should simply apply it to everyone, cut out all the discrimination.
800-462-7413, our number if you have a question for Zorba. And to the phones again now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Kingsland, Georgia. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how can we help?
Well, I had a question about ultrasound. I'm about 3 months pregnant now, and I've read some information, some articles about the risk of cavitation or heating of bone structures that could cause risk to my baby if an ultrasound is done for too long or done improperly. And now they have these 4D ultrasounds. And I was just wondering about the safety and if I'm just being overly cautious.
Well, you should be overly cautious. You're the mom. You know, so, I mean, that's your job.
That's your job.
Your job is to be overly cautious. Well, I'm a student of a physician who died years ago, Bob Mendelsohn. And Dr. Bob Mendelsohn was the gadfly of medicine. And he was against hospital births the way they were done in those days. And he produced major changes in hospital births.
Yeah.
They were not done in a humane way. He was for home deliveries. I'm not for home deliveries. He was against all immunization. He thought immunization was quackery. He was wrong. He also went overboard when it came to HIV. He said everyone in HIV should be put like in TB sanitariums and not allowed to mingle with the rest of society.
But he was right when he talked about how going into the hospital can be a danger.
Absolutely. He talked about hospitals as basically being cesspools of disease, and those were important things. But Bob was against ultrasounds, and he was worried about that. He was worried that ultrasounds would heat up things, cause birth defects, and thought a minimal number of ultrasounds should be done. And I'm on his side with that in a certain way. The ultrasounds have been shown not to cause damage. They are safe when used properly. On the other hand, if you do too many of any tests, you wonder about it. So I'm for the appropriate use of ultrasound in a minimal way. I think there's lots of hype on the net that show the ultrasounds cause this, that, this, and that, and that has not been proven at all. There's no science that they cause birth defects, cavitation, or anything else. However, even given that, I believe in Bob's rule, which is first do no harm. A minimal amount of interference with technology is still useful. So there are some OBGYNs who do an ultrasound every single visit. Well, they do an ultrasound. They also put through a charge every single visit, and they may get more money from it. Now, that doesn't mean they're doing it for the money. They may be doing it because of the training. But I think an ultrasound with ultrasound, you should still do it a minimal amount of time. You are pregnant now? How pregnant? I'm sorry?
3 months.
3 months. And have they done an ultrasound?
I've refused them so far, but I do have a 20-week ultrasound scheduled to look at fetal age and organ development.
Mm-hmm. So I think an ultrasound once during the pregnancy, if things are fine, is okay. But I think an ultrasound at every visit can be overdoing it and can also, just like we do too much laboratory testing, can lead to looking at things that are not really necessary to look at. So I think an ultrasound at 20 weeks are fine. And then you say, if things are fine, do I ever need to have another ultrasound? That's really the issue. I think if you're then developing properly and things are good, minimal ultrasound is still the way to go.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. And before the next call, Zorba, let's take another email. This curious question comes to us from a listener named Ken, who writes, Dear Zorba and Tofu Tom.
Tofu Tom, I love it.
Love the show, says our emailer. What is boiled coffee? Is coffee from a French press boiled coffee? Have you heard of this? Thanks for your help. By the way, the grammar police should be locked up.
Well, a French press is not boiled coffee. Boiled coffee is where they put coffee in a pot and boil it. Yeah, and then they put it through a strainer, so they don't do it. And those are issues because that's not as healthy as, we'll say, a French press or a regular drip coffee. And there's some questions as to whether or not it causes esophageal cancer and other issues involved. So, and that has come out in research that was quite old. Mm-hmm. But boiled coffee is where you literally do it. And the only time that I think I've ever boiled coffee is when I'm camping, you know, and put the coffee in the coffee pot and kind of boil it and then put it through a strainer. So that's boiled coffee.
My Uncle Dudley.
Yes, Dudley. Okay.
Had to do the dishes after breakfast. Mm-hmm. For breakfast, he had a bowl with juice in it.
Okay. With juice in it?
He would mm-hmm. drink the juice. Yeah. When it was finished, mm-hmm. he would put the cereal in the same bowl.
The same bowl.
And he had a spoon.
Because he had a spoon.
And then he boiled coffee in his bowl.
And then he boiled coffee
so
and put it in the
for
bowl.
Dishes, he had to wash the bowl and the spoon.
That was it. Dudley did not like washing dishes.
If you have a question for the good doc, Zorba's here to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Frazee, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on apple cider vinegar. I have trouble with my blood sugar, and I tried several different things, and someone mentioned that helps break the sugar down from my pancreas, so I've been trying it. And it seemed to help a little bit because I take it before meals. Either that or it tastes so bad, I don't want to eat that.
You know, maybe you've invented a new diet. We'll call it the apple cider vinegar diet. Just put in a glass of apple cider vinegar, maybe 6 to 8 ounces, and drink
we
it with your food.
10, 15 pounds.
No problem. You know what? There's a book here somewhere, a best-selling book that I'm looking for, followed by a PBS special and Facebook.
Can I write the foreword?
You can write the foreword. Right. That's right. Apple cider vinegar. And, you know, it's interesting. It's one of those folk remedies that has continued for years and years and years. A guy who's name I keep on forgetting. I thought his name was Howard Jarvis, but I don't think his name was Howard Jarvis. That was, but he wrote a book called Apple Cider Vinegar in Vermont, which was also named Folk Remedies in Vermont. And he wanted apple cider vinegar for everything, heart disease, cancer, stroke. This is back in the 50s. Best-selling book. And so he started manufacturing something called Honeygar, which was apple cider vinegar and honey together. And then the feds said, wait a minute, you can't proclaim it's going to cure cancer and write a book at the same time. It's either A or B. Either you sell it and take away those claims or you write the book. So he stopped manufacturing it, became very wealthy writing the book, lecturing back in the 50s. And anyway, the results are, I don't think it helps break down sugar at all. There are a lot of people who take some apple cider vinegar every morning. One of them happens to be my daughter-in-law, Louisa. She has 1 or 2 tablespoonfuls of apple cider vinegar, and she says she feels much better. Sort of wakes her up and makes her feel alert.
Whatever works.
So, and for colds, for sore throats, but I don't think it helps break down your sugars. Now, what's the difference in how you feel? Why do you feel it helps break down your sugars?
I don't know my results showed a little bit, but like I said, I ate less too because I would take some before any meal, and I was only taking 2 meals a day then. Oh. But my sister and her friends, they take a teaspoon at work to get the gallon out, and they all take their tablespoon
of it. They get out a gallon of it. Of course, it is cheap and inexpensive. I have a question now. You said your numbers were better. That means you mean your numbers were better at your doctor. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no, on my meter. It went down to the 120s, where otherwise I would be high 200.
Okay, so you've got diabetes, obviously. You're on medicine?
Yes.
You're on medicine for that?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
What are you on?
On several things, but I might be going on insulin at the end of this month.
So okay.
I tried that for 2 months, but towards the last of the jar and a half, it would come back up the aftertaste, and it had a sharp taste. And I just thought, geez, I'm going to find out first if it really is.
Okay, so you're on the border of whether or not you're going to need insulin. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. Tell me about your weight. How much do you weigh?
220.
Okay. What'd you weigh after high school?
170.
Okay. So the reason I ask that is there's a relative. We look at a high school weight that most people kind of know when they leave high school. They put on weight after that, you know. And unless they're overweight in high school, which of course some people are, I kind of like to compare that. So here it is. You're 50 pounds more than you were in high school. What do you think you were 10 years ago? Do you have any idea?
180. I didn't break 200 until a few years ago.
Okay, so what your goal really is, if you were, like you said, you were 170 at high school, you were 180 just a while ago, and now you're up to 220 and you're looking at insulin. So my recommendation is whatever you can do to lose weight is going to make a difference. If apple cider vinegar is part of that, by all means do it. Weight Watchers, excellent program. Oprah thinks so because she just bought an interest in Weight Watchers, 10 or 20%. And obviously a diabetic diet, but I would look towards some diet and exercise. I have patients who are ready to go on insulin. Many of them go on insulin, but some of them actually pick up the ball, essentially score a goal, and they do that by weight loss, fewer calories and more exercise. So I would hit that, and maybe apple cider vinegar is part of the whole thing.
Thank you. And there is no ill effects from it.
No ill effects at all. Keep up the good work, and you could even buy a small amount. It is inexpensive in the store.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And before we head out today, Zorba, how about we let one of our listeners give us a piece of her mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc. The following email is from a listener named Marianne. She writes, on a recent show, you told a caller that sucking snake venom out of a bite was very advantageous. Sucking is worthless. Please reread about proper snake bite protocol. It has been updated dramatically. Thank you.
She's right. It turns out sucking really does not do very much at all. Snake bite kits can be somewhat useful, but she is absolutely correct. The best thing to do if you have a poisonous snake bite is to try to get thee to a hospital as soon as possible.
Yeah. Do you disagree with something Zorba said? Or maybe what he said just plain sucks?
Oh,
just
gosh.
Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or don't forget Facebook.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0113Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
From PBS.